April 19, 1775, marked the end of an era. On that day, the first shots of the Revolutionary War were fired at Lexington, Massachusetts. Some 6.5 years later, on October 19, 1781, the British forces surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia. What had started as a fight for the rights of Englishmen in the 13 colonies ended in the creation of an independent nation, the United States of America. Life in the 13 colonies had been going on undisturbed by the English for over 100 years. The great distance between the colonies and the mother country was one reason for this. Another was the British involvement in wars on both the European and American continents. The pressure of these wars gave the British very little time to concern themselves with what was going on in the colonies. During this period, the colonists learned to manage their own affairs. British policy toward the colonies changed abruptly in 1763, after the French and Indian War. As a result of winning this war, England became the dominant power on the North American continent. The war, however, had been an expensive one, and the English people were heavily taxed. Now, in addition to the war expenses, there was a vast new territory that England had to govern. It was at this time that the British government began to feel that the colonists should pay their share of the costs of the colonial administration, including a post-war army. Britain wished to avoid the possibility of any further trouble between the colonists and the Indians and the Spanish. It was, therefore, decided to maintain a standing army in the colonies. Because the army would protect the colonists, the British government believed that the colonists should help pay for it. To reduce the possibility of trouble on the western frontier even further, the British issued the Proclamation of 1763. This closed the lands west of the Allegheny Mountains to further settlement or colonization. Both of these measures angered the colonists, who felt that they were now being taxed unfairly and that their freedom of movement was being unjustly curtailed. In 1764, the Revenue or Sugar Act was passed by Parliament. The molasses trade between the colonies and the French and Spanish West Indies had been extremely profitable for the colonies. This act made the tax on molasses from the French and Spanish West Indies much higher than that on molasses from the British West Indies. It was hoped that the colonists would buy from the British islands or pay the tax. Customs officials were given more power. They were expected to enforce the tax on molasses, as they had not done before. The colonists felt that these measures, and those that followed, violated their colonial charters and their rights as Englishmen. They argued that they had no representatives in the government at London. No taxation without representation was the cry that echoed through the colonies. The British government, on the other hand, argued that the interests of all Englishmen were represented in Parliament, whether they had a representative there or not. The colonists rejected this argument and said that their only legal allegiance was to George III, not to Parliament. In 1765, the British Prime Minister, George Grenville, persuaded Parliament to pass the Stamp Act and the Quartering Act. The Quartering Act required colonial authorities to provide certain supplies for the British troops stationed in the colonies. The colonists were angered by this, especially by a provision of the Act saying that under certain circumstances, they would have to quarter British soldiers in their homes. The Stamp Act required the colonists to pay for stamps on all legal documents, business forms, and even newspapers. This stamp on legal documents and business forms was really not so unusual. In fact, even today, legal documents, playing cards, and cigarettes must be stamped. However, the colonists were not used to being taxed, and especially resented being taxed by a parliament that did not represent them. The British government never expected the storm of protest that the Stamp Act created in America. The Stamp Act was denounced in every colony. Never had Americans felt themselves so oppressed. In the past, there had been objection to other taxes, tariffs, and duties, but not to the extent evoked by the Stamp Act. Royal agents attempting to enforce the act were beaten by angry colonists. A Bostonian named James Otis agitated strongly against the act. "Taxation without representation is tyranny," he declared. Boston became the center of colonial defiance of England's tax policies. A mob of Bostonians ransacked the home of Thomas Hutchinson, Royal Lieutenant Governor. Rioters burned the barge used by the royal tax collector. Tempers ran high in Boston, and discontent boiled up in each of the 13 colonies. Citizens' groups called the Sons of Liberty sprang up in all the colonies to protest against the Stamp Act. By October 1765, opposition to the tax served as the basis for a Congress. The Stamp Act Congress, with delegates from 9 colonies, met in New York. It was the first intercolonial meeting summoned by the colonists themselves. Among the speeches delivered, one suggested the new idea of colonial unity. Christopher Gadsden, a South Carolina merchant, proclaimed, "There ought to be no New England man, no New Yorker known on the continent, but all of us Americans." If the delegates were not yet ready to accept that proposition, they did display enough solidarity to draw up a Declaration of Rights. This declaration suggested to the king that the colonies could do their own taxing, since they were not represented in Parliament. The Stamp Act proved unenforceable and was revoked after a year. But any colonial jubilation over the repeal soon ended, for at the same time, Parliament passed the Declaratory Act, which said that Parliament had every right to tax the colonies. New, more hateful taxes were passed by Parliament in 1767. These were the Townshend Acts, which placed a duty on many products brought into the colonies from England, particularly lead, glass, paint, paper, wine, and tea. Colonial reaction to the Townshend Acts was furious, since the new law provided for a blank warrant known as a writ of assistance, which empowered any officer of the king to search a man's home for taxable goods. It became quite respectable, especially in busy Boston, to smuggle goods taxable under the Townshend Acts. In 1768, King George, annoyed by the widespread flouting of the law in Boston, ordered 4,000 soldiers under General Thomas Gage to be sent there, along with a flotilla of warships. The Americans would be shown their place. The Redcoats, or Lobster Backs, as Bostonians nicknamed the British soldiers, received a cold welcome. Townsmen and soldiers brawled in taverns and on the streets. The situation grew more tense, and serious violence seemed imminent. Matters came to a head on March 5, 1770. Some boys taunted a British sentry walking his post at the customs house on King Street. A group of local toughs gathered and began snowballing the sentry. The guard called for help. A squad of soldiers came with bayonets fixed to their loaded muskets. The crowd, which had swelled into a mob, grew ugly. Sticks, brickbats, and snowballs showered upon the troops. Suddenly, a British musket went off, then a ragged volley raked the threatening mob. When the gun smoke had cleared, 5 civilians lay dead in the snow. Among them, a free black laborer named Crispus Attucks. Several Bostonians were wounded by redcoat bullets. The ugly affair was labeled the Boston Massacre. In 1770, Lord North, Prime Minister of Great Britain, had repealed all the Townshend Acts except that on British tea. Because there was still a tax on such tea, the colonists refused to buy it. As a result, the British East India Company was in trouble and asked Parliament for help. In 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act. Although this act made the price of British tea lower than any other, there was still a tax on the tea. The colonists, on the principle of no taxation without representation, refused to buy the tea. Sam Adams called for an American boycott of tea. The Sons of Liberty enforced the boycott, often with violence against offenders. Lord North, however, was not to be intimidated. On the night of December 16, 1773, there were 3 tea-laden cargo ships from England at anchor in Boston Harbor. Several hundred Bostonians, disguised as Indians, raided the vessels and dumped 342 cases of tea into the water. This was the Boston Tea Party. Much the same thing took place in New York Harbor, but the Boston Tea Party had serious consequences. while the affair in New York has been nearly forgotten. The tea dumped into Boston's harbor was valued at $75,000, and the British reacted vigorously to this act of defiance. Lord North's government drew up the so-called Intolerable Acts. One of these acts was the Boston Port Bill, which closed Boston Harbor to all shipping. Warships of the Royal Navy patrolled the harbor mouth, and Boston was effectively blockaded, except for a narrow neck of land that connected the city to the mainland. Only over that route could supplies reach Boston. The wealthy port faced both hunger and economic ruin. Massachusetts also was limited in its practice of self-government. This punishment was to continue until the citizens of Boston paid for the tea that had been dumped. To prevent mob violence, General Gage placed the city under martial law and brought in hundreds of soldiers. The Bostonians proved more stubborn than the British. They refused to pay a cent. Word of Boston's plight was sent out to the other colonies. The people of New York, Connecticut, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Charleston rushed food and money to the surrounded, besieged, and beleaguered town. Every colony rallied to Boston's support. In September 1774, the First Continental Congress was held at Philadelphia. The delegates drew up a list of rights and grievances addressed to the people of Great Britain. At the same time, they pledged support for Boston. The winter of 1774 to 75 brought growing discontent to Boston. Because of the port bill, ships lay rotting at anchor, commerce was at a standstill, and unemployment grew each day. In April 1775, Parliament passed the Restraining Act, which forbade the colonists to trade with any country other than England and the islands of the British West Indies. Recruits swelled the ranks of the Sons of Liberty. Flames of revolt were rising in Boston, but the British ignored the obvious military preparations of the Americans. Neither Gage nor his officers could seriously consider bumpkins, peasants, and illiterate plowboys a threat. Not only did Gage deride the American militiamen, he was fully convinced that the port bill would eventually humble Boston into submission. This viewpoint was supported not only in Boston, but in every colony, by persons called Tories or Loyalists. These individuals remained faithful to King George III and considered the Patriots traitors and rebels. Obviously, ill will existed between Tories and Patriots. This bad feeling was to cause much bloodshed in the coming years. In February 1775, General Gage began to take the military actions of the Patriot group called the Minutemen more seriously. His men began looking for hidden weapons, and on several occasions they narrowly avoided clashes with the Minutemen. The main American arms storehouse was at Concord, about 20 miles from Boston. To protect the guns, shot, and powder concealed there, the Americans decided that if any large British force was sent out of Boston, all available militia would assemble to block the foe. On April 15, 1775, a leading patriot, Dr. Joseph Warren, received word that Gage planned to send 700 infantrymen toward Lexington and Concord. Sam Adams and John Hancock were hiding at a house in Lexington, evading warrants for their arrest. Dr. Warren sent a messenger to warn them. Word was passed to move the arms from Concord, and the courier returned to Boston. He was Paul Revere, an engraver, silversmith, coppersmith, cartoonist, artist, and goldsmith. In addition to having all these talents, Revere was a superb horseman. Gage did not strike on the 15th, but on April 18th, rebel spies warned Warren that Gage was ferrying troops across the Charles River for a swift march against Lexington and Concord. Warren sent Paul Revere and William Dawes to rouse the Minutemen. All that night, Revere and Dawes rode, in the words of Longfellow's poem, through every Middlesex village and farm, spreading the alarm that the British were coming. Patriots leaped from bed, grabbing their powder horns, cartridge boxes, and flintlocks, just to mobilize at prearranged points. At dawn, on April 19th, the British column reached Lexington. Fewer than 100 Minutemen had gathered to face the Redcoats. The British commander, Major John Pitcairn, ordered his men to spread out. Awed by the sight of so many soldiers, The Americans, under Captain John Parker, broke ranks and began to straggle away. Suddenly, a shot rang out, and then others. 8 Americans, including Parker, fell dead. 10 others were wounded. The American Revolution began at that moment and in that place. Later, at Concord, Minutemen drove the Redcoats from the town with sniping fire. From behind every rock, tree, and hill, men and boys blasted away at the British. The hated Lobsterbacks withdrew from Concord and retreated toward Boston. Their march was plagued almost every foot of the way by American marksmen. Before the day was over, more than 70 Redcoats were dead and 173 were wounded. Lexington and Concord unleashed a terrible storm over the 13 colonies. Patrick Henry of Virginia had voiced the sentiments of most Americans in March when he thundered, "I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Still, the colonists were divided among themselves at the start of the war. Thousands still supported the crown. Before long, neighbor fought neighbor, and brother turned against brother in a bitter civil war between Tory loyalist and patriot rebel. General Thomas Gage soon realized that what the Americans lacked in military skill, they made up for in bravery and determination. He soon found himself in an unenviable position. Some 6,000 militiamen commanded by General Artemus Ward ringed Boston and kept Gage locked up inside the city. The only route open to the British was by sea. Day by day, Ward's army grew more numerous as detachments marched in from Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Vermont. Leaders who had some military training also joined the forces besieging Gage. Israel Putnam, a veteran Indian fighter, John Stark, a veteran of many frontier battles, and young Nathaniel Green were among the leaders. The Americans did not sit still. On May 10, 1775, a detachment led jointly by Ethan Allen of Vermont and Benedict Arnold, who commanded the Connecticut governor's foot guard, surprised and captured the British stronghold of Fort Ticonderoga on the southern tip of Lake Champlain. Allen's Green Mountain boys swarmed into the enemy fort with hardly a shot fired. On June 17, 1775, a major clash took place between the Americans and the British. General Ward had some troops dig in on heights overlooking the British lines. The Patriots entrenched themselves on Breed's Hill, next to Bunker Hill. After a furious bombardment by naval and field guns, General Gage sent several regiments under General Sir William Howe to do the job. The British regulars started up Breed's Hill as though on parade, but their perfect alignment was shattered by a murderous volley from the militiamen on the hilltop, who had been ordered by one of their commanders, William Prescott, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes." Again and again, the Redcoats tried to storm the crest, only to be beaten back. It was not until the Americans had run out of powder and shot that they yielded the position. Taking the hill cost the British 1,054 dead and wounded out of 2,300 men assigned to the task. American casualties numbered about 500. Among the fallen was Dr. Joseph Warren, who had sent Paul Revere off on his immortal ride. When the battle was over, a young British officer exclaimed, "I can't believe it. Those bumpkins fought like Englishmen." "Of course they did," another officer said. "After all, they are Englishmen." At the very moment that fighting was raging on Breed's Hill, a less spectacular but more momentous event was taking place in Philadelphia, where the delegates to the Second Continental Congress were gathered. A Massachusetts delegate had proposed to the Congress the formation of an army responsible to Congress and not to the colonial legislatures. This was a novel idea, and a stirring one. With such an army in the field, a trained, disciplined force, the British would not be facing raw militiamen. Such leading rebels as John Hancock and John Adams thought that a Continental Army would be a good thing. They argued in favor of the proposal, and Congress voted to create a 20,000-man regular army, which would incorporate in its ranks those militia forces then serving against the British. Selecting a commander-in-chief for the new army called for careful consideration. At last, after much debate, Congress chose a 43-year-old Virginian, a man of wealth and position whose name was George Washington, already a colonel in the Virginia militia. Washington had fought in the French and Indian War. He was a good organizer, a man of quiet strength who inspired confidence. The newly appointed commander-in-chief went up to Boston and took over the Continental Army at Cambridge, Massachusetts, on July 2, 1775. The troops he inherited were more an armed rabble than a disciplined military group. The American camps were unruly. But after Washington came, the men began to behave in a more soldierly manner. He worked and drilled them relentlessly. There was little action for the army around Boston that winter. The American forces had the British penned up in Boston, but Washington did not know how long he could keep them hemmed in. There were rumors that reinforcements were on the way for General Howe, who had replaced Gage as commander in Boston. Washington knew that a determined assault by superior British forces would break his siege lines. He needed cannon to bombard the British positions. Somebody remembered that at Fort Ticonderoga there were heavy guns, and Washington's chief of artillery, Colonel Henry Knox, offered to bring this equipment from the captured British fort. The fortunes of war turned for the Yankees in March 1776 when Henry Knox finally reached Boston with the cannon. Washington mounted the guns on Dorchester Heights. The fear of a devastating American bombardment was so great that General Howe evacuated Boston by sea. Some thought he was sailing for Halifax, Nova Scotia, but others, including Washington, believed that Howe intended to attack New York City by land and sea in a major effort to capture that great port. Washington guessed Howe's intention. Late in June, a British fleet numbering 130 warships carrying thousands of redcoats arrived in New York Harbor. It was followed in July by another fleet of 150 ships carrying more redcoats and Hessians. Hessians were German soldiers hired by King George to fight for England. The British landed on Staten Island, ferried over to Brooklyn, and drove the outnumbered Americans from one defensive position to another. A succession of battles in Brooklyn, Long Island, Manhattan, and White Plains ended in American defeat. The major battle took place on Long Island on August 27, 1776. All rebel resistance around New York City and Westchester was broken. During this campaign, Captain Nathan Hale was executed by the British for crossing their lines to get information for Washington. The British occupied New York in mid-September 1776. Shortly afterward, a mysterious fire, probably set by patriots, destroyed most of the city. Meanwhile, Washington, pursued by strong enemy forces under General Lord Cornwallis, retreated to Peekskill, New York. From there, he crossed the Hudson and began a long and grueling march through New Jersey. He crossed the Delaware River near Trenton and paused to rest his exhausted men. At the time, Washington had only 5,000 men. They were thinly clad, hungry, poorly armed, and disheartened. Never had the American cause been at such a low ebb. The Second Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia, passed the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. The motion for a Declaration of Independence had been made on June 7th by Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, and it was Virginia's great statesman, Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the text. The patriots were now fighting for their freedom as a nation, the United States of America. The Declaration of Independence gave a new dignity to the American cause.